based on the pasuk, which we'll learn today, we look at tzitzis and somehow we're reminded of all the mitzvahs of Hashem. It's a gateway, it's a portal. No other mitzvah. Raymond, we're waiting for you, thank you. We waited for you until last minute. No other. Give a seat to Raymond. Come on. He was falsely accused. Okay. Yeah. By the way, I didn't have time to tell you yesterday, the guys who left Shia early, this woman who made Aliyah yesterday, this Russian woman I showed you the article, she's the daughter of one of the most famous, infamous victims of the pogrom. And his name was Mendel Bayless. And he was accused, he was a servant in a Christian home in Russia. And in 1911, he was accused of murdering, I think, the girl in the house and using the blood for matzah. And that started 2 years of very, very harsh pogroms. I think he was in prison, but it led to a public outcry, and then another trial internationally. It became a real international case, but it exposed this simmering hostility towards Jews underneath, you know, which are already the great pogroms, not the great pogroms, the vicious pogroms of 1880. So he ended up running to Israel to save his life. And she says, I'm here to save lives. Yeah. My grandfather ran to Israel to save his life, and I'm here as a doctor making Aliyah voluntarily to save lives in Israel. But that was a very, very celebrated case. If you look up, like I just put a post yesterday on my Twitter, and I just wanted to make sure I had the details correct. So I just plugged in Mendel Bayless, and you know, the whole Google exploded. It wasn't like someone there. So just if you want interest in this, it was a very interesting article. Anyway, getting back to mitzvahs. What makes tzitzis such a portal? Why, if you look at tzitzis, you remember all the mitzvahs? Like what about tzitzis jogs your memory? So we all know the famous Rashi, but it's a fascinating Rashi. What does Rashi say? Gematria. Tzitzis is how much? 600. 400, tough. 90 is 580. And then 2 yuds is 20, so that's 600. And then if you take the 8 strings and the 5 knots, then it's 613. Now, it's interesting. I once tried to find this because 90% of Rashi are Midrashim. Rashi's not making up things on the fly. He's quoting Midrashim. It was very, very hard to find the Midrash. Rashi says it in the Torah, in Parsha Shlach, and he says it in Menachos, or Daf Mem Gimel. Maybe we'll see it today. But I looked for it in Chazal. It doesn't. It's certainly not in Shas. It's Rashi in Shas. But certainly, it's very hard. I found one Midrash that says it, which made me start to think that maybe this is not the primary way that Chazal read the pasuk, which is Zechariah is called Mitzvah Hashem. And then I remember, wait a second, there is a primary way that Chazal read the pasuk, and it's Rabbi Meir, and we'll read it in a second. Because Rabbi Meir says, the way that tzitzis introduces you to all the mitzvos is the color of tzelis, which we'll see in a moment. But Rashi in France, in the 11th century, doesn't have tzelis. So he has to create, again, based on Chazal, but he has to find a different mechanism for using tzitzis as a gateway to all of mitzvos. So that's why this whole, again, there is one Medrash in Chazal. It's not a very popular Medrash. Again, some of these Medrashim, it's hard to know when they were written. Not all the Medrashim were written at once. But let's even assume that this Medrash was written in the days of Chazal, but it really becomes popular in Rashi's period when there's no Tcheles and people have a hard time understanding mitzvah tzitzis as a gateway to all the mitzvahs, as we'll talk about in a moment, based on Tcheles, because they haven't been wearing Tcheles. So Baruch Hashem, we're wearing Tcheles. So what does the Gemara say? So you don't have your Gemara. Is that a Gemara Menachos? Yeah, let me have the Gemara for a second. What does the Gemara say in Menachos Mem Gimel? It's actually Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was one of the Tamina of Rabbi Akiva. Meir was a visionary. I'm intrigued by Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is one of the Tanaim. I'm really not excited to meet every Tana. I'm intrigued by Rabbi Meir because the Gemara in Erevin says Rabbi Meir would walk into the Beis Medrash and he'd say there are 49 ways logically to prove that something is Tahar. And then he'd say there are 49 ways to logically prove that it's Tamei. Which means that he wasn't dealing in human-sized truths, which is binary, one or the other. We have to make Kiddush one way, or put on tefillin one way, or make brachas a tefillin one way, actually two ways. He was dealing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's endless ratzon. When we get to Olam Haba, you're going to learn Torah very differently. When we get to Olam Haba, there's not going to be something called Psak Halacha. Psak Halacha tells human beings how to behave, how to take a lulav, how to put on tefillin, how to make Kiddush. We're not going to make Kiddush, put on tefillin, or make tefillin, but probably not, but certainly not lulav and sukkah. So all of a sudden we'll be spirits and we'll be discovering and discussing Hashem's ratzon, and all these opinions will have meaning because we'll see within each opinion different ideas in it about Kadosh Baruch Hu's ratzon. So I'm very intrigued by someone like Rabbi Meir. That's why we often know Paschal and Rabbi Meir, because I think it was hard for people to understand him. The Gemara says it was very hard for people to follow that. I'm very intrigued by that. I'm also intrigued by his relationship with his Rebbe. There's something about him that allowed him, who was his Rebbe, Asaf Rebbe Akiva, his infamous Rebbe, Rishab ben Avuya, and somehow he felt he was able to throw away the klipa and just take the course. So Ramirez is a very interesting He was also a great writer, and I'm someone who's into writing. He was such a great writer. I don't know if a writer or a speaker, but generally people who write well, speak well, speak well, write well. But then when he taught his students, he taught his Talmidim in very, very succinct and clear language. Because remember, before the Mishnah was written, all the Tanaim were teaching their Talmidim, you know, their Torah. And much of the Torah overlapped. Conceivably, when there's no machlokas, the Tanaim were saying the same things. Now, when Rabbi Yehuda had to quote Shittos, he decided to quote primarily from Rabbi Meir because his writing style, we talked about this earlier, was so concise. He quotes Rabbi Meir so much that he doesn't even bother tagging him whenever he quotes his position, which is why we paskin Stam Mas Nisan, Rabbi Meir, because 85% of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. So when he doesn't quote Rabbi Meir, Divrei Rabbi Tarfon, Divrei Rabbi Akiva, Divrei Lazar, Divrei Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, when he's trying to create a succinct and really easy to remember set of Mishnayos, he's quoting from people. And it's fascinating to me because there was a mayor, a Rev Mayor, about 130, 40 years ago, wrote a Sefer, and it went through a similar phenomenon where when you write things that are clear and lucid and tired, so excuse the words, uncommon clear, but I just think a lot about writing, people will read it more, people will use it more. Rabbeinu Meir, who was Rabbeinu Meir in the late 19th century, wrote the famous Sefer we use? Chafetz Chaim, what was his name? So Meir Kagan. So when he wrote the Mishnah Berurah, he never wrote it as the Psak Halacha. If you asked him when he was writing it, he wasn't saying, oh, I'm expecting this to replace all the Svarim. He was a Gadol, probably the Gadol Ador, and he was writing his Halachic opinion. And Rav Lichtenstein used to tell us that when he was a child, let's say in the 40s and 50s, in his world, they didn't paskin like the Mishnah Berurah. They actually paskin like the Pri Chadash, but very, very few people read the Pri Chadash. What happened with the Mishnah Berurah is, A, he was such a great Gadol, and his thinking is so clear, and his writing is so easy to read, and so that people just started using Mishnah Berurah so much and so often that it's basically become the baseline of Psak. Again, if you're a Gadol, you can say, I don't hold like the Mishnah Berurah here, but certainly people like you and me can say, oh, the Mishnah Berurah says Sazer, Sazer, and I don't hold like that without some dissenting opinion. But when people say, like, what's the last thing to look in the Mishnah Berurah? This is what we always hold like the Mishnah Berurah. But that's like the baseline. In 2021, the Mishnah Berurah forms the foundation of our Psak. I'm sure all your Rebbes, and we talk about the Masorah that we share, because I want you to get a sense of shared Masorah. You're going back to your Rebbes, they're a little different, they look a little different, they sound a little different, they live in America, but basically, we're all coming from the same base Medrash. And most of your Rebbeim will say, okay, just follow the Mishnah Berurah. Now, in this case, do we follow Mishnah Berurah? Maybe not. Maybe Rav Moshe Feinstein argues. Maybe the Rav held a little differently. Maybe. But basically, we establish the baseline, the scaffolding is a Mishnah Berurah, and then we fill in the building with some differences from time to time. Anyway, so what does Rav Meir say? The Gemara Menachos, Mem Gimel on the base, Rav Meir says as follows. Hayah Rav Meir Omer, Ma Nishtana Tcheles Mikol Minei Tzivonim. Right? Fifth question of Ma Nishtana. You'll say it the Seder next year with your parents. They'll say, you want to ask the Manishtana, Gabi? So I have a fifth Manishtana. Where Menachos? Manishtana Tcheles Mikol HaTzvayim. The Meir says, and in other Midrashim, the Meir's opening is, how do you know you remember the mitzvahs? So what is? Who knows what the Meir says? What makes Tcheles unique? Well, when you look at Tcheles, you think of a lot of things. I'm not going to have enough time to teach you all of them. But according to the Meir, when you look at Tcheles, what do you think about, Mati? What? The sky. The Yam. Look at the blue, it looks like the water. And then when you think about the water, what do you, the ocean, what do you think about? The sky. And you think about it two ways, not just color, but why else do they think of the sky when you think of the ocean? Right, space, but also when you look at the ocean, you see the sky, you see the horizon. When you look out at the ocean, at a certain point, the sky and the ocean meet one another. I mean, it's just natural. And anyone who's looking at the ocean is seeing the connection, the fusion between the sky and the ocean. Then when you think about the sky, which is Tcheles, then all of a sudden you think about what's the next thing you think about? Domer liyam, yam domer rakia, rakia lekisei akavod, shenamar v'tachas raglav k'maisa livna satsapir chesem shamayim latoar. So somehow, in ways that are hard for us to understand, in Parshas Mishpatim, Hashem's kisei akavod is described as sapphire blue. Tachas, again, I don't know how to read this pasuk for you, don't expect me to read the pasuk, don't expect anyone to read the pasuk, but underneath the legs, which would be a metaphor for the kisei akavod, k'maisa livna satsapir, like the like sapphire stones, or chatzim hashemayim latorah, like the white of the sky. Whatever that means. And what's Reb Meir saying? How does tzitzis help us perform mitzvos and avoid averos? And in particular, why doesn't Reb Meir just say, oh, you look at the blue, and you think about the kisei hakavod, right? Why is this, I look at the blue, I think about the ocean, I think about the sky, think about the heavens, think, like, why this whole odyssey? Why this whole trip? Just say, look at the blue, and you think about Hashem. why am I getting to Hashem mitzvos and avoiding averos by thinking about oceans and skies? What about looking at blue? What about oceans and skies are important? Hashem isn't in the ocean. He may be in the sky, but he's not in the ocean. I mean, he's everywhere. What? More than that. All right, what do you think?
In the past year, we learned in Shabbat, in the Kodesh, and I remember that like the sea serves Hashem out of Europe, and
okay.
The sky serves Hashem out of Abba.
So it's a combination between the sea and the sky. So you think about Abba Hashem and Yiras Hashem, and that will help you with mitzvahs. Okay, what do you think, Gabriel?
It's a more like physical picture that you can have in your mind as opposed to just thinking about Hashem. What does that mean? You can see the...
Okay, but how does that help you? How does that help you become more of an Oved Hashem, more mitzvahs, less averos? I understand. I see something physical, but what does that trigger in me? What's going on? A little bit of what Ari said, but is there something else going on aside from just the Avira component? What do you think I say?
To us, the sea and the sky are so big, and we can't even comprehend how big they are. Actually, and we say, oh, they're so big, but Hashem is so much greater, we couldn't even
correct, correct. The Rav said that, well, I'll get to that in a few moments. Excellent. Azari said something similar to what the Rav will say. Let me change it a little bit for you. A little bit of what you said, Ari, a little bit different. Whenever you sin, it's a tragic barter that you're committing. What do I mean, the tragic barter? Every sin carries packs a punch, right? If you have a sin, you don't sin for no reason. If you're a psychopath to sin for no reason. You sin because you gain something. What do you gain? Physical pleasure. You gain an escape. Right? You lie because you know you're under pressure, and you tell a lie because you want to gain something. You steal from someone. You deceive someone because you want to win. Every sin, I mean, unless you're an idiot, every sin has some gain, has some benefit. And it also has a tremendous, tremendous price. And the sad part is that the price is never worth the benefit, because the price is eternal and the benefit is transient. So every sin is always a lack of perspective, a lack of proportion. If we really knew, if you saw, let's say for example, you saw your Olam Haba counter in heaven, and it was at a certain meter, a certain level, whatever that level is, let me just wipe my hands from a little bit dirty. And wherever that meter is, you saw, I'll get it later. You saw that every time you sinned, it was declining, it was diminishing. It would be really hard. Let me put it to you different. Let's say your whole life you lived with an awareness of Hashem akin to the awareness you feel in Ne'ilah. During Ne'ilah, we feel Hashem, we see Hashem, the Arun is open. Like if every minute we're Ne'ilah, there's no way we would sit. It's unfortunately we get confused, and that's the job of the Satan. The Satan isn't, there is no Satan. Satan and Satan are different things. Satan in Christianity is a rebel angel with a pitchfork who delights in stealing your soul away from Shemayim. That is hypocrisy. That is heresy for a Jew. There is no angel that has any will of its own other than Hashem. The only creature in this world to have will of its own, as I wrote my article, is a human being. You know what happens every day in Shemayim? There's a lineup of angels, and we read about it today when we davened. And all the angels line up, and Machiel lines up, and Gavriel lines up, and Raphael lines up, and Uriel lines up, and they all start their day by saying Shavach Hashem before they attend to their tasks. And you know who lines up right next to Gavriel and Malkiel? I can't tell you who's where, but you know who lines up in that lineup? The Satan lines up, the Malach HaMavis lines up. And they say, Shevach Hashem, and they say, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzavakos. And then they attend their tasks. You know the task of the Satan, Ben? To confuse you. You know the task of the Satan, Zevi? To make you weak. You know the task of the Satan, Benny? Make you desire certain things. Because if you saw Hashem as clearly as you do on Yom Kippur, to confuse you, make you tired, make you weak. I know the Satan has a big plan for me today. I am tired. Man, I'm drunk tired. I've got a lot of things to do. I got to make sure I keep my cool. I don't get testy. I don't take it out on people. I keep learning today. It's going to be hard for me to learn today. I don't really have a head to learn today. Will I learn properly? Will I daven properly? Will I be kind to my wife? Will I be kind to my kids? Because, you know, when you don't sleep, you get a little testy. So I know the Satan has it out for me. And you know why Hashem wants the Satan to do that? Because if the Satan didn't play with your mind, you wouldn't have free choice. Because if you saw the world as clearly as you do on Yom Kippur night, you don't have free choice. Like, you're not free to choose. For real free choice to be exercised, you need to have a choice. And if you're standing in front of the Aron HaKodesh every single minute of your life, no free choice. Every sin is a tragic exchange of your future for your eternity. If you just knew that on that cold winter night in Scarsdale, or in New Rochelle, or in wherever you are, Silver Spring, wherever you are, you're getting something. but you're giving something up for eternity. You'll get up to Shemayim and you'll say, I gave away millions of years for that stupid little moment. You kill yourself. You're mortified, but you forget. You don't see it. You lose perspective. You lose proportion. You forget. Some of the guys come and tell me, I'm going to college and should be involved in college life and be involved in student government. So look, it's a good point. You really want to be Osik B'Tzorach HaTzibur, but I'm here to represent people that you can't see yet. We're pleading with you to learn Torah, be a Talmud Chacham, so that one day you can sit at the table and share Torah and share Halacha. You haven't met them yet. They're your kids. They're your wife. You haven't met them yet, but I see them. I see the world. I've learned a little longer. I see them in the background. They're saying, please, David, whatever your name is, please, David, spend some time learning. We need you to be a Talmud Chacham as an Abba. We need you to be a Talmud. Please, don't just waste, not waste, but don't just spend time with people you'll spend 3-4 years with, which is important, but see the future. You got to live the future. Live with perspective. If you only get perspective on life, proportions, see things large, see them in context, you don't sin. Every sin is narrow, lack of perspective, head in the sand. I need this and I need it now. I want this and I want this now. Hashem, you see where Tzvi is? Go into the corner. I'll see you in 10 minutes. How many times do you tell Hashem, go into the corner, see you in 10 minutes? I just need 10 minutes off, Hashem. I need to do this right now. I'm a firm guy. I'm coming back. Go into a corner, Hashem. I need to be away from you for 10 minutes. And then in those 10 minutes, you're losing your eternity. The way to beat that, it's called perspective. It's to see it large. It's to step out. You're talking about this a little bit, as I see the world large. You'll be on a plane Monday afternoon, Monday morning. Some of you will be half asleep. Some of you will be looking out the window as you land JFK, Newark, where you're landing? No, wherever. And you're going to look down at your world, but from a totally different perspective, from 10,000 feet up. You'll see your big houses, but they'll look like little boxes. And you'll see the people that you encounter in the street, they look like little figurines. And you'll see the cars that you drive in that feel large and heavy and aluminum, and they'll see the little toys. And you're going to see yourself from a different perspective. Take a moment and think, well, because these are called swivel moments, where you had swivels, and you see the world differently. And you think about the world differently. You're taken out of your stale, rehearsed routine, the way you think about things, because we all wake up, it's like a computer program. We all wake up, and we're programmed. This is where we view life, this is where... And sometimes that programming stifles us. We can't see things real. When you change your perspective, when you see, this summer has been a change of perspective, right? I think hopefully, at least everyone in this room is going back to America. I love America. Olympic medals, the baseball, the football season. There are other people in this world. There are other Jews. There's a whole country called Israel. It's not just a place to visit and eat hummus and pita, but they're really serious people that are sacrificing for me and their life. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not, maybe I'm moving, I'm not. But it's not all just Powerline Road. There's a lot out there. When you look at Tchelas, you know what happens? You think of the ocean. You think of the sky. And you're taken out of your small little box and your small little room with your small little needs on a small little night, where you may fall into momentary, fleeting needs at the cost of something larger. It's so important in life to see the future. Live with people that smoke. Don't you know you're killing yourself? Yeah, it's not going to happen now. It's going to happen in 25 years. Yeah, funny, right? Talked about this before when I was in college. Long time ago, Civil War. I had one of those mustaches. Right after the Gettysburg Address, I had to run back from my calculus test. It was hard. Like, I made it back in time, but it was hard. It was a good speech Lincoln gave. Anyway, when I was in college, everyone's telling me you have to be an NCSY. Okay, I'm saying something against NCSY now, so maybe they'll fire me on the left. You have to be an NCSY leader and counselor. Not on the summer program. We didn't have NCSY summer camp, summer cola, but go on Shabbatons. I said, no, I'm staying home for Shabbos. Why? I worked really hard in college. I worked really hard. I learned to, I don't want to tell you later, I learned to, then I went to the computer room, something called the computer room. I saw a lot of sunrises when Yeshiva University. I spent a lot of sunrises watching the sunrise, finishing my computer programs. I wanted to finish in 2 years, which Baruch Hashem I did, because I wanted to get back to Eretz Yisrael. I worked, by the time Friday came, I was just deadbeat. Because I worked so hard in learning and on computers and math during the week, I wanted Shabbos to learn things that I would enjoy learning, read things that I didn't get a chance to read during the week, expand my horizons, fill myself with ideas, fill myself with some content. I remember people like, oh, you're selfish. You're selfish. You should be going to Schenectady to be an NCSY in Shabbaton. You should be going out to Allentown. You should be. I said, I don't think I'm selfish. I just think I'm selfless for the year 2021. This is 1985. Because one day I really want to be a Rebbe and I really want to share as much as I can with people. And to be selfless in 2000, I'm as selfless as I could be today. Guys, I'm exhausted. I've got tears running down my throat, so tired. I'm trying to help you. So here I am, 45 years later, whatever, 35 years later, and I think it came true. I think that my decision in 1985 to spend time at home, because in no way devaluing those Shabbatons. I just felt that there were other people who were doing them and they could do just as good a job. I wasn't like I was the best Shabbaton Madrich possible, the best Shabbaton counselor possible. Whatever I could have done in Schenectady, whatever I could have done upstate or Long Island, they were doing. And my job right now was to fill myself with as much content and ideas and drive and passions that one day I could share with guys like you who weren't even born then. I mean, you weren't even born to be born. This is 20, 30 years before you even thought about being. You got to see the future. So that's what Tchelos does. That's why it's important to see mountains. Look at the sky. Look at the ocean. Expand your horizons. Don't just get caught in the here and narrow, because when you get caught in the here and narrow, you'll get entangled and a lot of here and narrow value at the cost of long-term value. And that's why Tchelos is important. That's why Rav Meir is saying, you think Tchelos, you think of the sea. Oh, you think of the sea, you think of the sky. You think of the sky, you think, all of a sudden, you're not thinking about the Mets or your cell phone or your food in Gabby's and Carlos, Carlos and Gabby's. You're thinking about something a little bit larger. Sometimes, not all the time. And then there's a different shot, and this is what Azariah was talking about a little bit before. White, see, this is white. White is normally a color that's associated with two experiences. First of all, purity. White is snow, kashel gelbino, pure snow, white, clean, clear, right? White. What about blue? We know what red is. Red is the color of sin. We know what brown is. Brown is very earthy. We know what these colors create in us emotionally and halachically, right? Brown, there's no real halacha of brown, like what brown, a little bit of blood, and neither. We don't really have any halachas about brown. But when we think about brown, we think of earth, right? I don't know your home. Some of your parents like much more loud and fancy and shiny houses. We've got a lot of blacks and whites and silvers and shiny. If you come to my house, you'll see my wife likes much more down to earth, they call it. We have a lot of terracotta, browns, earth tiles. Like she wants that, that's the feel she likes. So when I think of brown, I think of, you know, earth, quiet, matte, not shiny. Different people have different styles. I've been in people's homes. You walk into the bathroom, black and white tiles. And that's what people like. I don't like that style. I like the style. You walk into my bathroom, stuff more, you know, brownish, a little orangish. Not tacky orange, but like earthly orange and green, light green. Okay, different styles. What about blue? Well, blue, Rav Meir says, that's the color of the ocean. Guys, is the ocean blue? No. The ocean is composed of water. What color is water? Clear. Transparent. Hey, wait a second. Is the sky really blue? No. Why is it blue? The sky is air and clouds. What do you think, Ari?
Well, I mean, a color in general is just how you perceive
it. Okay, so that's what the Rav said. The Rav said, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, blue is the color we associate with something we can't understand and is too deep to see. When we look at the ocean is so deep and such an abyss and so beyond human comprehension, listen, Azari, that it emits a color blue. So blue in our experience creates that association of something we'll never understand. The sea is beyond us. The sky is beyond us. Blue, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, is the color, not of logic and coherence, but of illogic and not understanding and mystery. We'll talk about this later. You know what Avodas Hashem is according to the Rav? Look at my tzitzis. The content The substance is rational. We try to understand mitzvahs, we try to understand gemaras, we try to understand Hashem, we try to understand history, we try to understand. It's wrapped in, encased in, and we'll talk about this in the Rambam Shita, the logic, the framework, the scaffolding, the envelope has to be a logic. You're never going to prove religion. You're never going to prove Hashem. You first have to accept that you'll never understand Hashem. The blue of the heavens, the blue of the logic, the blue of the ocean, and then start to read Gemaras, read Tosfos, try to understand Talmud and Mitzvot, try to understand Hashem, try to find Hashem in Tanakh. But you can't start with white. The case has to be blue. What a good phrase, Gab, I see you writing down. Reason elucidates what faith has already proven. Reason is meant to elucidate what faith has already proven. Had you been born Christian, Avram, I think the chances you would have discovered Hashem are pretty, pretty slim. Not just you, but me also. It doesn't make a difference. Hashem chose me, and Hashem delivered a Masorah to my grandparents and to me, and I accept that because the wisest people in life know how to accept, deliver truths, not to prove everything on their own. You guys live in a nightmare of self-mediation where this world denies the value of delivered truths and celebrates the value of proven truths, of cognition, empiricism, and that's, of course, a recipe for religious disaster. Not everything can be proven. I told you one day you'll be walking down the aisle to get married. There is no way to prove whether that marriage is going south or is it going to be successful. There's no cognitive, empirical way to prove. You just have to look inside your gut and say, you know, I trust. You got to learn how to sometimes people ask me, like, what's missing in America today? What's missing in Orthodox community? If you can create one value, what value would you like to impregnate every single high school kid with? What value would you like to install in every single high school kid? You know what it'd be? Trust. Because you live in a world without trust. Because everything you see has been proven to be false. Sports stars, oh, they're drug addicts. Celebrities, they're sex fiends. Politicians, those megalomaniacs. Everything you see in this world proves to be something different. And you just lose trust. And families are falling apart. So you're supposed to trust parents and learn how to trust. It's so important in life to learn how to trust people. If you don't learn how to trust people, learn how to find people that you can trust and put your trust in them, I promise you, you're not going anywhere in life. You're not going anywhere as a person. You're not going anywhere in relationships. You may think you're going places. You may have a lot of money in your salary. You're smart enough to earn a big salary. Woohoo. Smart enough to earn a lot of money. That's success in life. You have to find people you trust. Just the last couple of days, I've been doing work in my house on certain things. It's Ben Osmanen, gardeners there, whatever. Things happen. I say, I just trust this person. I look into his eyes. I can tell I can trust him. Whatever, there'll be a problem today. After I go to the car, I have to go to the store. There was a problem. I put in an air conditioner yesterday. It didn't work out. I just trust the guy's going to make it right. I just trust him. He's a guy right near the Katzefik where you guys ate the other day. I bought a unit. He put in. I just trust him. He's going to do the right thing. I just know this person. He's not going to give me a hard time. He trusts me. I'm an honest guy. He's an honest guy. Find a way to work it out. Otherwise, you're always in legal battles. Otherwise, you spend your whole life in the courtroom. Your whole life in lawyers, your whole life in litigation. You got to learn how to trust relationships. Ultimately, when you love someone that much, it's all based on trust. Don't ever, 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 ever break that trust. The second you break a trust, you're assassinating a relationship. Relationships are all built on trust. If you lie, or you deceive, or you let people down, you can't be trusted. And if you can't be trusted, there is no way to build a relationship. It's called the currency of trust. Like you need currency to go down and buy a Slurpee or a Freezy or Yummies, or you need currency. You need currency to get food. You need currency to have a relationship. If you can't, I'll tell you what. I always like making it real for you guys. When's the last time someone lost your trust? When's the last time you really invested in someone, you really believed in someone, and that person lost your trust? It was devastating. I can't go back to relationships. Those are, in my opinion, relationship breakers. I remember I was in high school, and I went to a high school that makes any of your high schools look like a conservative high school. I went to a really yeshivish high school, and I didn't agree with a lot of what the Rebbeim said, but I respected a lot of the Rebbeim. I just saw the way they conducted themselves, and their Avas HaTorah, and the amount of Torah they taught me. But there was one Rebbe who just, in the middle of 10th grade, did something to me. It was just so backhanded and so deceitful and so underhanded. He wasn't treating me like a person. He did something without telling me. He hurt me. To this day, I see him. I can't look. I shake his hand. I'm nice. I'm cordial. He lost my trust. He totally lost my trust. What? It happened 40 years ago. 44. I can't. People in your life, don't break trust. Find people you can trust. Be trustworthy. Be honest. Don't lie. Don't let people down. Be there when you're expected to be there. And I promise you have a really rich life of relationships. Okay. That's why Tzitzis reminds us. Number one, because you look at the blue and you think about large horizons, not just the small little needs of the moment. Number two, as you said, Azaria, logic encased in mystery. Write that down, everybody. Logic encased in mystery. That's what religion is. Okay. Stop here. Makaros. 11 o'clock, everyone's back here. We only have 40 minutes, but it's all cool. And we'll have an easy share afterwards, if so. But please, ask as many questions as you want. We're under no pressure to have share today, if you take the whole hour and a half. But please be back at 11 o'clock here, okay? Let's be on time, okay? Well, you bring your gemaras for the share. Here are the makaras. Bring your gemaras for the share, because, okay? On the makaras today, guys, if you don't have enough time to see every makar, what you should see is the Gemara, the Psukim, I quoted the Psukim from Shlach for you, Rashi, okay, the Mishnah, and the Rambams. Just those four. If you see more, then it's not that many Makaris today. This is our only Shiur on Tzitzit. We'll get back to Tefillin and Hashem on Thursday.